Lee versus Mukasey. Mr. Yerman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Gary Yerman on behalf of Petitioner. First, may I say it's truly an honor to be standing before this Court today, as it is my first appearance before this Court for oral argument. Mm-hmm. Your Honors, we believe that the agency abused its discretion in denying the motion to reopen based upon changed country conditions because the agency's decision lacked rational explanation.
Counsel, would you address the import of the recent Kuchana case on this matter?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for the opportunity to address that. We believe that this Court does have the jurisdiction to review this issue because the abuse of discretion is relative to Section 208 of the Immigration Nationality Act, which provides an exception to the Court's ability to review discretionary issues. That 208 governs political asylum, and this Court does have jurisdiction to review discretionary denials under political asylum claims.
That strain of argument was rejected by Ali, and Kuchana extended Ali to motions to reopen.
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that this Court has jurisdiction to review this issue because it's a question of law, and we believe the agency abused that discretion.
Whether it's a question of law or an abuse of discretion are two sort of mutually exclusive things. So
yes.
It's got to be one or the other. If it's an abuse of discretion, if it's a discretionary judgment, there's no jurisdiction. If it's a question of law, jurisdiction is preserved by the saving clause of the statute.
Yes, and thank you for allowing us to clarify. The question of law is there enough reasonable evidence to establish that there's been a change or worsening in country conditions under 8 CFR 1003? In this situation, Your Honor, we have a respondent who was before the Court in 2001, had her immigration hearing, was denied. In 2006, she filed a motion to reopen based upon change country conditions and the fact that she's prima facie eligible based upon those changed country conditions that she has two children. The evidence in record in 2001 through the country reports stated that there was sporadic or minimal enforcement of the family planning population. The evidence submitted with the motion to reopen, including the 2005 country report and the 2006, which we asked the BIA to take administrative notice of, which they have the authority to do, clearly states that there's been an increase in enforcement of the family planning population and even widespread campaigns.
But have you seen our opinion that was issued yesterday, the Lynn case?
Yesterday's case?
Yeah. Was issued. No reason you should have seen it. It just came out yesterday. It's a very similar case, but a difference is in that case there was a very similar angle, actually it was identical statement by the local government, the villager committee, about the threat of sterilization. But in that case, the government didn't question the authenticity of this ominous statement by the villager committee. But in the present case, the government did, and the board found it inauthentic. So that's a big difference, right? Because
you
then you're left with the fact that the changed country reports indicate, you know, new laws concerning the one-child policy, but not clear from the change from the country statements how this is enforced, whether it's just a fine, and if you can't pay it, that's the end of it, or whether it's the prelude, whether there's actual sterilization.
So. Well, I agree with you. There is no smoking gun, but it's not our burden to show that it's definitive or beyond a reasonable doubt. It's our burden to show that there's a reasonable likelihood. And it's our contention that the country report does show that there's a reasonable likelihood.
Reaching into, you know, the question Judge Sykes raised about discretion versus error of law, it's a somewhat fine distinction. At some point, when the board has to decide, is this a serious enough threat to create a well-founded fear of persecution, is that a discretionary
It's a discretionary, Your Honor, but it's a discretionary question that must be based upon reasonable minds, because the question is, would a reasonable person fear returning to China based upon the one-child policy after having two children? And it's our contention that a reasonable person would fear that. Now, if you're asking us to provide something that's definitive, we're not going to be able to do that. But we can't keep – the agency can't keep moving the line, the burden in the sand, farther and further, saying, well, you have this, but we cannot simply extrapolate. It's actually – it's our responsibility to extrapolate from the evidence what is a possibility of what can happen. And this evidence is clearly different than what was available at the prior hearing.
The problem, it's different, but it's different by shade. That's why in the Lin case we actually relied heavily on the document from the local government agency and also on what the government's lawyer said in the argument. Maybe we'll hear something from the government's lawyer and make your case. But,
no, you want to be before
barring that. If the board has to weigh, you know, how much has Chinese policy changed and how much threatening is it? Also, what about the issue of, I don't know if this raised in this case, whether I'm confusing with other cases we're hearing today, but isn't there the question of relocation? This seems to be a problem in Fujian province. Can't your client go live elsewhere in China?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree, and on two grounds. One is it's not our client's burden to show that he must be able to move in other areas of China or he has the ability, okay? And number two is the part I disagree with is, no, only recently has the State Department report confirmed that the Fujian province has been has increased their campaign of family planning. Actually, this was the 2005 country report that stated the Lin Yi province had an escalate of family planning population problems, and they took into custody 130,000 Chinese citizens and put them into population schools, and thereafter sterilized 7,000 persons who have violated the family planning. So the family planning policy is a...
How many provinces are there in Egypt, in China?
Well, I would defer that to Mr. Cox, who is arguing in the fourth slot today. He's more familiar with that.
A number of provinces, and if this is a local government thing, if the local governments have a lot of discretion on enforcing this, then maybe there are provinces that your client could return to without a substantial risk of...
Well, Your Honor, the family planning policy law is a uniform law throughout China.
It's national, but then it's implemented.
The implementation is different. And the implementation, like any law, is slow to evolve. And at this point, it is evolving and expanding out to countrysides where the areas used to be so rural before, there may not have been an ability to guide and to focus on this issue. Whereas opposed to large cities, the implementation has remained consistent. But I think it's important to just address one issue the court raised regarding the village letter.
What is her educational level?
She is in middle school, which is about 15 years old. Okay, and if you move to another area of China...
She's not college?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. And that was the argument I'm going to talk about on reserve, the BIA argument, matter of TZ regarding economic fine. Now, there's evidence that establishes that the average income for the Fujian province is 10,000 RMB a year, between 10 and 12,000. There's documentation confirming that. So if there are fines that are between 30 and 50,000, the math is clear. But I think it's important to realize if you move to another area of China, you must register in the household registration booklet in whatever area you're in. Whatever area you're in, once you register in the household booklet, the Chinese government becomes aware of your marital status and how many children you have. So you're not able to avoid any repercussions just by simply moving to another province. I reserved a few minutes on rebuttal. I would like to discuss TZ at that time.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Yerman. Ms. Talia Shmerny.
May it please the Court, my name is Aliza Talia Shmerny. I represent the government of the United States of America. The government would like to reframe the issue. We've spoken of the burden that petitioner would face to show that she has been persecuted or that she would have a reasonable likelihood of persecution. In petitioner's circumstances, the board was correct in determining that the motion to reopen did not warrant reopening. Namely, the board did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion because the change in petitioner's personal circumstances do not establish or excuse the untimely motion to reopen.
Would you address the jurisdictional question that I raised?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we haven't done so yet in our brief. I would be glad to.
The decision was just issued on Monday, so it's not your fault or your opposing counsel's fault. The Kuchana decision is what I'm referring to, which applied.
Right. And obviously the government believes that any issue that's discretionary, the court has no jurisdiction to review it. I would be glad to submit a 28-J letter on that issue. Unfortunately, I'm just not properly prepared to do so at this time. Petitioner and her father came to the country in 1999. Neither of them had proper valid entry documents. They attempted to come in Atlanta, Georgia in 1999. They both were immediately placed in removal proceedings. They filed an asylum application based on religious persecution in 1999. At that point, they stated they based their claim on the fact that they were Chinese Christians. Their claim was not found credible. They were denied relief at that point. They appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals. The immigration judge's decision was in 2001. The board's decision was September 12, 2002. At that point, they did not appeal that decision and bring it into the court. Instead, after seeking voluntary departure, the privilege of voluntary departure, petitioner did not depart. At that point, she stayed in the country illegally, subject to a final order of removal. She chose to marry another Chinese national at that point with a final order of removal, and she decided to.
Well, the person is given the privilege of voluntary departure. There presumably is a deadline set?
Absolutely.
What happens when a person doesn't leave at the deadline? It's no follow up. There's no.
Absolutely not. And I believe in listening to the argument in the Lin case about a month ago, I remember that you had a similar question with respect to DHS's responsibility at that point. In 2000, I have the Department of Homeland Security records here. On December 11, 2002, petitioner was given what's called a bag and baggage letter, stating basically you have a final order of removal. You have not left. We have information that you're still here. We need you to show up at a Department of Homeland Security office with everything. Let me see. On Tuesday, January 7, 2003, at this place, completely ready for deportation. At the time of your departure, you will be limited in amounts of things that you can bring and that sort of thing. At that point, when petitioner failed to show up, she was a fugitive.
Presumably they knew her address. They don't go go to the person's address.
I think the question of resources is an issue that's... It's an absolute astronomical question. The idea of, the question of criminal versus non-criminal aliens and how Department of Homeland Security decides to remove individuals. What the Department of Homeland Security has decided to do is require showing and compliance and then execute a warrant subject to that. At that point, if somebody, if the Department of Homeland Security comes across them, they are removed. Sure. So they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're not just letting somebody, fall through the cracks.
I was just curious why.
Right. I think that the resources of the number of people that would be placed and that sort of thing is a policy Department of Homeland Security call. So as explained, these aren't circumstances that just befell petitioner. She decided to avoid voluntary departure. She decided to avoid the Department of Homeland Security. She decided to get married and have two children. And this is properly, unlike some of the other precedent that's dealing with the Fujian province, a motion to reopen that's untimely. And specifically, petitioner needs to show that the circumstances were a change in country conditions, not in personal conditions. And she's failed to do so. On top of that, we have all of the current board decisions on what's required for an individual out of the Fujian province to successfully reopen her case. As a matter of SYG showed, relevant change in country conditions, which we argue she has failed to do so, there is not a marked difference between 2001-2002, when the immigration judge and the board proceeding happened, and 2005-2006. In SYG, JWS, and JHS, the board specifically took administrative notice, which it can do, of the most recent country conditions. And the mere fact that more pages are dedicated to what is going on with family planning policy doesn't necessarily mean that the conclusions that you draw from those are different. If you look at 2001 and 2002, there was pervasive enforcement of family planning policy. The law went into effect in 2001. And actually, on that note, the family planning policy regulations that petitioner submitted with her motion to reopen were put into effect July 26, 2002. Now, that was the social compensation fees and one of the things that they relied on to establish the change in country conditions. That's not different. That was in a place. It's not new and materially different. That was in place back at the time that she was moving through her removal proceedings. The only difference at this point is that she has two children, which is a change in personal circumstances. On top of that, I believe this court has been focused on whether economic sanctions can rise to the level of persecution, because as SYG stated...
Was she ordered removed in 2001 or 2002?
2001 was the immigration judge's decision, I believe, and 2002 is the board.
2002.
September 12, 2002 was the board's decision.
Because in the Lin case, which we issued yesterday, I don't know if you saw that either, we referred to a July 2002 Fujian regulation.
Exactly.
Which said that the social compensation fee for three children, how many does she have?
She has two.
She has two, so that would be less. But this,
which both live in China. Both children are in China at this point.
She's just exceeded it by one. Lynn had exceeded it by two, and she was subject to six times her annual income. So I think this person, Lee, would be subjected to three or something. But was that clear back? Was the size of the social compensation fee clear back in?
The numbers are the regulation that you referred to. Back in that day, as I said, petitioner's board decision came down September 12, 2002.
So that's after this, right?
Okay. And it was after the July 26, 2002, which obviously is no different.
Right.
Unless, as the government has stated, petitioner failed to carry her burden on all three. No relevant change in country conditions. There's no the record doesn't show, and the board has looked at whether U.S.-born children count. I'm sure in the Lynn decision you paid attention to that. Economic sanctions.
One thing I find troublesome, I realize, the board has its problems, but in our Lynn case, our yesterday's case, we had this letter from the Villager Committee of Chang Li in Fujian, which was very emphatic about the threat of sterilization. The letter in this case from a different village appears to be identical, and that's quite suspicious. But as I said, in our Lin case, nobody questioned the authenticity of the Chang Li letter. And, of course, maybe it was fine, but this letter from a different village, identical, that sounds fishy. So
absolutely, Your Honor.
But is there some mechanism by which the different board members or the Justice Department, the immigration section, somehow compares these things, so one finds, you know.
The burden is on petitioner to authenticate her documents before she submits them to the Board of Immigration Appeals. It is not a new procedure. It is not rare. The fact that these are unauthenticated matters, and I think that the fact that the board took note of that is absolutely what they are supposed to do.
Well, no, it's fine for them to say it's not authentic, but they didn't seem to notice that apparently the identical document is being submitted on behalf of different people purporting to be from different villages, which doesn't sound right.
I would, you know, obviously...
so I just wonder
if there's
some...
I agree, if there's a feedback loop or something like that. I understand the question. I believe that they do notice, and they do have...
A pattern of fabrication.
Absolutely, and I think that that's why they weigh the evidence as they do. I see that my time is out. I'd like to just, if I could have a second, just state
sure.
The government respectfully requests that the appeal be dismissed and the change in personal circumstances and, rather than country conditions does not warrant an untimely motion to reopen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Aliashmirny. So, Mr. Yerman, you have, how much does he have? 1 minute?
Speak best, Your Honor. Let me briefly address that issue. Your Honor, on a personal basis, personal experience, we've had many village letters submitted by the government for forensic that has come back valid. And in the last 2 years, with my appearing in immigration court almost on a daily basis, the Department of Homeland Security no longer sends those village letters out for authentication. I don't know the answer as to why they don't, but I do have 6 or 7 forensic reports from the Guangzhou Embassy in China confirming that these letters are in fact authentic. Now, lastly, everything the government said regarding factually what happened to the petitioner is true. She did come. She did lose her case. She was ordered removed. However, the regulation is clear and unambiguous on its face. Therefore, somebody at some point thought that this type of factual circumstance may arise, somebody who does have a removal order against them. And that's why there's an exception to the 90-day filing requirement if there are changed circumstances in the country. So we cannot hold against the petitioner the fact that she's been ordered removed if there's a law that provides an exception to somebody in her circumstances to reopen it. But for the evidence...
Of course, the concern is a person who's ordered removed doesn't leave, and then later there are changed country circumstances. So then the motive for remaining is the hope that changed circumstances will... provide a basis for a reopening.
And the judge hit the key word, the hope. There are no guarantees that these people who have had children would later on find out that the country report corroborates their personal fears. I have Brazilians, Russians, and Africans who have overstayed removal orders, who have children, who want to reopen their case, and my answer to them is, no, you cannot reopen your case. And it was only this perfect storm that has allowed the petitioner to file this motion based upon the evidence that the 8th Circuit and the 11th Circuit have found enough to warrant reopening. Now, lastly, Your Honor, under the matter of TZ, severe economic persecution is a form of non-physical, and this court recognizes that, and we would just urge the court to follow your past findings on that. Thank you very much,
both counsel, and thank you for your very good arguments, because we've been critical at times of the immigration adjudication process, but we appreciate your efforts on behalf of your respective clients.